When I drove through Beverly Hills in the depths of winter, searching for the house where Franz and Alma Werfel settled, the yards were mobbed by gardeners, tending to grass planted in a desert at the foot of a tectonic cliff. The Werfels' house is on a road like many others in Beverly Hills, lined with 50-foot palm trees that form a colonnade like a Roman cardo. The street is a kind of movie set, with each house done in a different style. A Tudor, a Spanish mansion, a Bauhaus type, an Italian palazzo, all side by side, with gated driveways and intercom systems. I thought of ringing the bell at the Werfels' former home, a large colonial, until I noticed the foot-wide sign on its lawn from the Greater Alarm Company. Down the hill in Santa Monica, it's clear that not all of Fry's famous clients shared this level of success. Heinrich Mann had crossed the Pyrenees with the Werfels, sharing their joyous escape from doom. But when I arrived at his home, a ground-level apartment in a concrete block painted in unpleasant pastel colors, I saw no alarm company logos. Instead, the door to Heinrich Mann's final home was marked by a large sign that read, "This area contains chemical substances known to the state of California to cause cancer, reproductive toxicity, birth defects, and other reproductive harm." I left quickly, as did Mann. Dismayed by his Pacific paradise, in 1950 he accepted a position as the first president of the German Academy of the Arts in communist East Berlin, just to escape America, though he died in Los Angeles before returning home. At the end of my tour, I drove to Villa Aurora, Leon Feuchtwanger's palatial home in Pacific Palisades, which is open to visitors. The house was a demonstration home built by the Los Angeles Times in 1927. Modeling the most modern living in the Los Angeles suburbs. It has specially insulated walls, earthquake protection features, and a living room that converts to a silent movie theater with an organ for accompaniment. But when the Depression hit, no one wanted an enormous house, and when the Depression lifted, wartime gas rationing made the suburbs undesirable. The Feuchtwangers bought the Spanish-style mansion on the cheap when they arrived in 1940. Today, it is used as an artist's colony for German writers and filmmakers. Feuchtwanger quickly resumed his pre-exile success and reassembled his 30,000-volume library, which I explored while enjoying his panoramic views of the Pacific. The house's property used to be much bigger, I was told by the young German woman who took me through the villa, but at some point most of the backyard fell off the cliff, leaving behind only a strip of grass on the edge of a precipice. My guide told me this in a bland voice, as though it were perfectly normal for the earth to fall away beneath one's feet. Feuchtwanger, formerly an outspoken communist, apparently had no doubts about his new home or his sense of self. As I left the villa, I was handed a postcard photograph of a middle-aged Feuchtwanger smiling, posing in his California courtyard with his two pet turtles. The triumph of the refugee artists in New York is legendary. Not only was there a new mode of painting developing in New York by the mid-1940s, wrote the art historian Martika Sawin, but it was emerging among those artists who had the greatest amount of contact with surrealist émigrés. Artists like Marc Chagall redefined urban spaces with public art around the world. Works by Max Ernst, Marcel Duchamp, André Masson, and others entered the permanent exhibitions of major museums. Their students had names like Robert Motherwell and Jackson Pollock. Even the rescuers themselves went on to enjoy fruitful careers. Hirschman, Fry's right-hand man and expert in all things illegal, became an architect of the Marshall Plan and a world-renowned economic scholar at Harvard, Columbia, Yale, and Princeton. Miriam Davenport worked for Albert Einstein's Emergency Committee on Atomic Energy, exhibited as a sculptor and painter, and eventually earned a doctorate in French literature. Charlie Fawcett, Fry's police wrestling doorman and ace messenger, went to Hollywood and acted in more than 100 movies, at one point starring opposite Sophia Loren. But Varian Fry, if he had lived to be interviewed by Pierre Sauvage, would probably not have been smiling. His life after his return from France was not a story of success. He could barely keep a job or a wife. He worked for a time at the New Republic, but resigned when he became more anti-communist than his fellow traveling journalists. He later worked for other publications, but could never get along with the boss well enough to avoid being fired. Leaving journalism in a principled huff, he bought a small TV production company and ran it into the ground. He took a job writing corporate literature for Coca-Cola, but was fired for insisting that Pepsi's drink dispensers were more effectively illuminated. He took a job teaching Latin at an Episcopal school, but was fired for playing his classes a recording of Tom Lehrer's Vatican Rag. Lucy Fuchs, a relief worker who had been in awe of Fry's commanding presence in Marseille, told Sauvage how disoriented she was when she ran into Fry in New York in the 1950s, making cigarette commercials. In Marseille, he was God, she said. And then, suddenly, he was nobody. His personal life was worse. His marriage to Eileen dissolved almost immediately upon his return from France in 1941. His second marriage to a much younger woman named Annette Riley in 1952 lasted longer and produced three children, but was difficult long before it ended. Annette, who for decades took charge of Fry's papers and legacy thanks to the fact that Fry did not amend his will in the 2 weeks between his divorce and his death, insisted in her interviews with Sauvage that Fry was happy in his post-war life. "Guys who came back from the war didn't talk much about it," she told Sauvage. "I do not get the feeling that he was living his life, pining after the glory days. He used to say to me that he wanted to be a regular guy and learn about baseball." But Fry went through extensive psychoanalysis and even participated in Alfred Kinsey's study on human sexuality. To his children, Fry was a distant father at best, and he was not often at his best. His daughter still refuses to speak of him. Ultimately, the Fry family's attempt at a suburban post-war idyll could not endure the vagaries of Fry's restless soul. He had thrived in the knife-edge world of wartime Marseille, but what he could less easily endure was what Auschwitz survivor Gerda Weissmann-Klein once described as every concentration camp inmate's abiding fantasy, and the title of her 2004 memoir, A Boring Evening at Home. Behind Fry's angst was something far more profound than the boredom of a war hero living out his days behind a picket fence. He was genuinely anguished over the fate of the thousands, even millions, whom he had been forced to leave behind. And in his anguish, I saw what was missing from Sauvage's interviews with his smiling colleagues decades later. "I have tried, God knows I have tried," Fry wrote in his memoir's unpublished preface, "to get back again into the mood of American life, but it doesn't work. If I make others see it and feel it as I did, then maybe I can sleep soundly again at night." After his expulsion from France, he tried in every way he could to continue fighting. He tried to enlist in the army, but an ulcer kept him out. The Office of Strategic Services, the CIA precursor that had run covert operations in Europe during the war, didn't want him either. His work in Marseille had involved too many contacts with possible communists. He then tried screaming his head off about what was happening in Europe. In 1942, he wrote a cover story for the New Republic titled The Massacre of the Jews, reporting with hard evidence on the murders of over 2 million Jews in Europe. "There are some things so horrible that decent men and women find them impossible to believe," he wrote, "that such things could be done by contemporary Western Europeans, heirs of the humanist tradition, seems hardly possible." He pleaded for the one thing he knew would have saved the Jews of Europe, offering them asylum in the United States. His plea was roundly ignored, to the tune of 4 million more murders. He then devoted himself to writing Surrender on Demand, his memoir, in the hope that it would bring more attention to those he had abandoned in Europe. But the war had been won by the time it was published, and the book received little attention. Americans wanted to hear about their own heroism, not about their failures. What was perhaps most painful for Fry after his return from France was the dissolution of his relationships with the artists and intellectuals he had saved, or rather, the revelation that those relationships were themselves a sort of fiction. Franz Werfel, whom Fry had personally escorted out of France, refused to return Fry's wife's phone calls on Fry's behalf while Fry was still in Marseille. Walter Maring, the celebrated German poet who had not only been Fry's client but also a personal friend of Fry and his staff, settled in Los Angeles and signed a lucrative contract to write screenplays for Warner Brothers. Fry's committee had advanced him 30,000 francs to establish a new life in the United States. Refugees were not expected to pay back such loans, but Maring's deadbeat status became harder to swallow when he began cruising around Pacific Palisades in a pricey new convertible, while Fry's committee was still scrounging for money to save more lives. When Fry found a publisher for his memoir, his former client Leon Feuchtwanger wrote him a complimentary note, "Your narrative of the events is so impressive that the reader can't help experiencing them with you." But the narrative was apparently not impressive enough for the world-famous author to offer Fry any help getting the book reviewed or read, or even a blurb for the jacket. Their personal correspondence begins and ends with that congratulatory note. Voigtwanger's lack of gratitude toward Fry's mission actually dated back to 1940, when he first stepped off the boat in New York. At the pier, he began giving interviews in which he thoroughly detailed his escape from France, down to the route he took over the Pyrenees. The risk this posed for Fry's committee's safety, along with that of Voigtwanger's fellow refugees, can hardly be measured. But Voigtwanger couldn't have cared less. Soon, he would be living in a model home built by the Los Angeles Times, with his wife and turtles. The refugees' ingratitude became painfully clear in 1966, the year before Fry's death. That year, Fry decided to raise money for the International Rescue Commission, a philanthropic group loosely evolved from Fry's Emergency Rescue Committee, by putting together an album of lithographs from the artists the committee had rescued. Fry thought this would be simple. After all, he had saved these people's lives. It wasn't. Reading Fry's papers from that year is an enraging experience. Nearly every page involves some frustrated effort to convince refugee artists to support the group that had saved their lives. There are endless telegrams and letters back and forth in 1966 and 1967 between Fry and Chagall, Fry and Chagall's agent, and Fry and Chagall's second wife, all of whom provide various excuses as to why the renowned artist was unfortunately unable to provide Fry with the time of day. Chagall, whom Fry had not merely supplied with a visa, but even personally sprung out of jail when the French police were about to hand him over to the Gestapo, finally did agree to provide a lithograph, but refused to sign it, deliberately reducing its value by orders of magnitude. Fry asked André Breton, with whom he had lived at Herbel, along with Breton's wife and young daughter, to write an introduction to the album. No amount of begging could convince Breton to do it. In a letter to a friend, Fry tried to justify the failure of so many artists to respond to him. Artists don't answer letters, usually, if they even read them, and the telephone is no substitute for physical presence, repeated physical presence. He began searching for funding for a trip to France. After seeing Max Ernst's show at New York's Jewish Museum, Fry begged Ernst to participate, eventually yelling at him by mail, "I do not want the album to come out without something from you in it." Ernst would ultimately have even more reason to be grateful to Fry. As I read through Fry's maddening correspondence from 1966 and 1967, the last 2 years of his life, I came across an incident that I had not seen reported anywhere else. In 1966, a German newspaper published an article claiming that Ernst, who was not Jewish, had deliberately abandoned Luisa Strauss, his Jewish ex-wife and the mother of his son, to the Gestapo, while he trotted off to fame and fortune in America. In reality, Ernst had offered to remarry Strauss for visa purposes, despite being involved with Peggy Guggenheim at the time. Fry was concerned that a fake marriage by the likes of Max Ernst would endanger the whole rescue operation, but in the end, he was willing to try it. The only unwilling party was Luisa Strauss, who preferred taking her chances with the Nazis to remarrying Max Ernst. She died in a Nazi prison camp. When Fry heard of the smear against Ernst, he went to tremendous lengths to clear the artist's name. I saw how Fry had dug up copies of the receipt for Luisa Strauss's American visa, and then how he had solicited affidavits on Ernst's intentions from the former U.S. consuls and vice consuls, from the curators of the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and from witnesses who had been with them in Marseille. But Ernst still largely rebuffed Fry's request for a lithograph, capitulating only when Fry arrived in France in September of that year to beg him in person. The stress of pleading with Ernst and many other artists during his trip to Europe became so severe that it landed Fry in a French hospital with his first heart attack. Part of this ingratitude was mere celebrity vanity. As Fry once wrote to his wife, "Mrs. Guggenheim says Chagall is a shit. Jewish ladies are so outspoken." I guess she's right. But the lack of graciousness was not unique to celebrities. Pierre Sauvage, recalling his research in Le Chambon, pointed out to me that many of those rescued declined to even acknowledge their rescuers in later years. This was partly because they simply wanted to forget the greatest horror of their lives. But there is also something inherently shameful in the rescuer-rescued relationship. The humiliation of being reduced to depending on another person for survival. And that shame expresses itself in resentment toward rescuers. Gratitude is what makes you hate someone, Hannestein, a German-Jewish journalist with whom I shared my bafflement about the legacy of Varian Fry, told me. Stein argued that this type of resentment was completely natural, and he offered his own country as a prime example. "Germans hate America," he went on. They have three reasons to be grateful to America. America saved them from themselves, rebuilt their country after the war, and saved them from the Soviets. And that's exactly why Germans hate America. If we are honest, we must admit that there is a profound shame in the fact of the Holocaust from the Jewish point of view as well. And I wondered if my discomfort with rescuer stories came directly from that shame. How on earth, Fry's rescued Jews and dissidents must have wondered, could we wildly successful adults have gotten ourselves into this pathetic situation, where our lives suddenly depend on the religious commitments of a pig farmer or the intellectual ambitions of an oddball like Varian Fry? The shame is only highlighted by the enormous difference in the experience for the rescuers and the rescued. For those rescued, it was the worst time of their lives, when their lives had the least significance. For the rescuers, it was the best time of their lives, when their lives mattered most. Everyone Fry saved had been living a nightmare. Yet, as he left France, Fry wrote to his wife, "I have had an adventure, there is no other but this good Victorian word, of which I had never dreamed." That good Victorian word and the literature it evokes brought me back to the question raised for me when I'd read Fry's New Republic article on the massacre of the Jews, in which he marveled that such atrocities could be committed by the heirs of the humanist tradition. It was to preserve that very tradition, of course, that Fry had gone to France to, as he put it, save culture Europe, stop. As I peered into this chasm between rescuers and rescued, I saw that there was something equally strange about this grand goal of saving Western civilization. What, after all, did that humanist tradition consist of? What were its greatest achievements, its highest values? What did those rescued intellectuals actually believe? And when Fry was trying to save European culture, what was he trying to save? Searching for answers, I looked to the writings of one of the Emergency Rescue Committee's biggest success stories, Hannah Arendt, and realized that I had somehow managed to reach adulthood without ever reading Eichmann in Jerusalem, a report on the banality of evil, the book for which Arendt is best remembered. Amazed by this gaping hole in my education, I read it on my flight to Los Angeles, and then read it again on my way home. Based on Arendt's reporting for The New Yorker on the trial of the high-ranking Nazi, the book is most famous for its assertion of how banal the accused appeared, that Eichmann was not a cackling evil genius, but rather a boring bureaucratic man, and that this sense of tedium was itself the Holocaust's prime novelty of horror. I knew this before opening the book. More than half a century later, that insight has become almost banal itself. But Arendt's chief argument in that book, I discovered, is actually to convince her readers that the source of Eichmann's, and by extension the Nazis, evil, was Eichmann's inability to think. "He was genuinely incapable of uttering a single sentence that was not a cliché," she writes, and later elaborates. "He merely, to put the matter colloquially, never realized what he was doing. It was sheer thoughtlessness, something by no means identical with stupidity, that predisposed him to become one of the greatest criminals of the period." Yet Eichmann, as Arendt describes him, spewing clichés at his trial, did not appear to me at all as a person with an inability to think. He seemed rather like the opposite, that is, someone who had spent a rather astonishing amount of time thinking, absorbing ideas, and translating them into action. It was just that he had been thinking about bullshit, and in the process had become buried so deep in it that extraction had become impossible. Arendt did refine this idea in her later writings, but as I read and reread this book in my airless middle seat on my cross-country flights, I found myself wondering why it was so important to her to claim that Eichmann wasn't capable of thinking. What if he were? Arendt also claims that the premise of Eichmann's trial in Jerusalem, where he was tried not only for crimes against humanity, but for crimes against the Jewish people, was fundamentally flawed because for the Jews, as Arendt put it, the catastrophe that had befallen them under Hitler appeared not as the most recent of crimes, the unprecedented crime of genocide, but on the contrary, as the oldest crime they knew and remembered. Arendt calls this the misunderstanding at the root of all the failures and shortcomings of the Jerusalem trial. But I couldn't help wondering if the Pitlura pogroms in Ukraine in 1919 to 1920, in which more than 50,000 Jews were murdered in an explicit attempt at genocide, hadn't looked incredibly unprecedented, or if the vast totalitarian brainwashing of the Inquisition, as it used creative rhetoric to convince people to turn their Jewish neighbors in to be burned at the stake, hadn't seemed impressively novel at the time, or if the populist innovation of the Roman Empire, turning the torture and murder of rabbis into public stadium-filling spectacles, didn't strike a philosopher or two as the most recent of crimes. I thought of more examples like this, 2 or 3 per century, just off the top of my head, but it soon became tedious, and I bored even myself. Evil may or may not be banal, but killing Jews sure is. I finished Arendt's book wishing I had liked it, and worried that my failure to appreciate her perspective was a reflection of my own inability to think. I went to my local library and read a collection of her essays titled Responsibility and Judgment, which was on the shelf next to Ayn Rand's The Virtue of Selfishness. In her 1971 essay, Some Questions of Moral Philosophy, Arendt reflects on the disappearance of morality in Nazi Germany. All this collapsed almost overnight, as though morality suddenly stood revealed in the original meaning of the word as a set of mores, customs, and manners, which could be exchanged for another set. Did we finally awake from a dream? As I returned the book to its place beside The Virtue of Selfishness, I recalled that the American Yiddish poet Yankiv Gladstein had thought the opposite. For those who had been awake enough, there had never been any dream at all. Born in Poland in 1896, Gladstein was a secular man and American enough to have enrolled in law school at New York University. In his searing April 1938 poem, A Gute Nacht, Welt, Good Night, World, he wrote, Good night, wide world, big, stinking world. Not you, but I slammed the gate. Go to hell with your dirty cultures, world. Flabby democracy with your cold compress of sympathy. Good night, electric, impudent world. Back to my kerosene, tallowed shadows. To my pages inscribed with the divine name, my biblical books, to judgment, to deep meaning, to duty, to right. World. I step with joy toward the quiet ghetto light. Good night. I'll give you a parting gift of all my liberators. Take your Jesus Marxes, choke on their courage. Croak over a drop of our baptized blood. From Wagner's idle music to wordless melody to humming, I kiss you, cankered Jewish life. It weeps in me, the joy of coming home. This poem has haunted me since I first read it as a 20-year-old student at Harvard, a place I slowly came to understand that could teach me many things, including how to think, but that could not teach me goodness. Not because it taught the opposite, but because moral education is simply not what secular Western education or secular Western culture is for. Varian Fry, my fellow alumnus, had noticed this too. When he'd interviewed the Nazi press official Ernst Hanfstengel in 1935 in Berlin, he was alarmed to discover that Hanfstengel saw him as a fellow Harvard man. An American with German parents, the clearly bright Hanfstengel graduated from Harvard College 27 years before Fry and later earned a doctoral degree. Like many Harvard-educated children of immigrants, Hanfstengel decided to return to his parents' native country in its time of trouble in order to improve it, to do the most good he could with his education. He soon became a personal friend of Hitler's and rose to the level of chief foreign officer at Joseph Goebbels' Ministry of Propaganda. The American had done well for himself and for his parents' country. In 1934, a year into his job as head of Hitler's Foreign Press Department, the Harvard Alumni Association appointed Hanfstengel vice marshal at Harvard's commencement for his 25th class reunion in recognition of his achievements as a high-ranking official overseas. Though Hanfstengel declined the honor after much controversy, he did attend his reunion, trailed by dozens of reporters and a security squad of local and state police. The Nazi regime's attitudes were no secret by 1934. 1,500 protesters met him at the dock in New York. But at Harvard, the sanctity of free intellectual inquiry prevailed, along with hallowed respect for diversity of opinion. The Harvard Crimson urged the university to give him an honorary degree. When Hanfstengel withdrew from the vice marshalship, he made up for it by donating $1,000 to the university as a Dr. Hanfstengel scholarship for students to spend a year in the New Germany. In his letter to Harvard President James Conant accompanying his donation, Hanfstengel wrote, "It is my profound conviction that my years at Harvard have since given me incalculable advantages, not the least of which consist in a knowledge of America and the world and in the spirit of discipline and fair play." According to the Fry biographer Andy Marino, Humpstengel opened his 1935 interview with Varian Fry by asking after their shared alma mater, and then bragging to Fry that the Führer himself enjoyed hearing him play Three Cheers for Harvard on the piano. Who wouldn't give three cheers for Harvard, after all, a place where few people, no matter how enormous their other faults, could be accused of Arendt's morally damning inability to think? Then Humpstengel told Fry that he and the other Nazi moderates were hoping to do the humane thing and export the Jews to Madagascar, while Hitler's faction of more radical Nazis planned to murder them all. When Fry concluded the interview, Humpstengel presumably offered his best wishes to the best minds in America, asking Fry to give his regards to their fellow Harvard men. One problem with Pierre Sauvage's theory of the righteous, that they are happy individuals with a deep sense of who they are, is that it doesn't describe Varian Fry at all. With the powerful exception of his time in France, there don't appear to be many periods in Fry's life when he was rooted in a clear sense of identity, or even simply happy. When I challenged Sauvage on this in his office in Los Angeles, he was defensive, even irritated. I really believe that when you read Fry during the war years, he does embody that sense of self-knowledge and happiness, Sauvage insisted. I think it's absurd to suggest that Varian Fry in Marseille wasn't the very embodiment of self-knowledge, of confidence, of knowing he was where he should be. It is certainly true that Fry was supremely happy and confident in Marseille. But there is something tautological about claiming that the traits that foster righteousness can be expressed only in a situation involving righteous conduct, and they can be painfully absent during the remainder of one's life. How relevant can such traits be, then, if we really want to learn from the righteous, to cultivate their traits in ourselves or to value these traits in others, as Sauvage is so eager for us to do? What really makes a person become a Varian Fry? Not long after my return from Los Angeles, I spoke with Varian Fry's son, Jim. Jim Fry is an evolutionary biologist and the proprietor of his father's papers. When I mentioned Sauvage's idea of rescuers being motivated by a deep sense of who they are, Jim Fry laughed. "When I think of my father," he said, "I don't think of someone who was secure in his sense of self." Jim Fry was only 9 years old when his father died, but I asked him for his impressions of his father, both from his own memories and from those of others who had known him. "He was a difficult person," he began, but clarified, "My father was mentally ill and struggled with that his whole life. If he were alive today, he'd probably be diagnosed with high-functioning bipolar disorder." Jim Fry is convinced that his father's mental illness was not something that he developed in middle age, but that he had struggled with it for most of his life, since long before his work in Marseille. He pointed to his father's departure from Hotchkiss, which biographers have made into a bold stand against hazing, and his year-long suspension from Harvard, which, as his father told it, was solely because of a prank he pulled by putting a for sale sign on the president's house. "Something about these stories doesn't add up," Jim Fry told me. "He was always alienating people, having weird outbursts." In one of Sauvage's interviews, Miriam Davenport recalled some of Fry's wackier antics, like receiving visitors in his boxer shorts, and said that she felt Fry was influenced by the screwball comedies of the 1930s. Yet the more I read about Fry, the more apparent it seemed that no such influence was necessary. The memoirs and biography of Lincoln Kirstein, the Harvard friend and future New York City Ballet founder, with whom Fry created the Hound and Horn Literary Journal, paint a picture of someone whose personal troubles long preceded the war. In his diaries, Kirstein recalled a party at Harvard during which Fry went nuts, ripping a telephone out of the wall and throwing it out a window. This seemed innocuous to me at first, until I realized that we were talking about a 1920s institutional wall-mounted telephone, the kind made of cast iron and wood. The episode was far from unique. The frequency of such incidents led to Fry's suspension from school. Kirstein's diaries also make it abundantly clear that Fry was gay, something that nearly everyone in Fry's life seems to have known, though the pieties of the era prevented nearly anyone from admitting it. In Marseille, it was obvious enough that even the Vichy police, trying everything to entrap Fry, sent both girls and boys to seduce him. I was raised in an era with its own silly pieties, so just as Annette Fry felt obligated to insert a notice into the papers at Columbia insisting that her husband wasn't foppish, I felt obligated to make one of the two currently pious claims about an important figure's homosexuality. Either that it was irrelevant to his heroism and that considering it relevant makes one a bigot, or that it was the fundamental influence in creating his sense of empathy for others. Neither of these is really true. Instead, Fry's sexuality seems like yet another aspect of his personality, like his intense intelligence and also like his mental illness, that made it impossible for him to lead a conventional life. And if one believes Pierre Sauvage's claim that the righteous are people who are rooted in an unshakable sense of their own identity, then the mental double life led by the twice-married Fry and the torment he put his wives and children through in its service would hardly seem to be a recipe for righteousness. Fry was sounding less and less like Sauvage's man jumping onto the subway tracks, the one so anchored in the world that he considers risking his life to save someone else to be no big deal. When I asked Jim Fry what motivated his father to take on the rescue mission, his answer did not conjure up anyone resembling the humble peasants of Le Chambon. "I'm sure some of it was a desire to be important and to hang out with famous people," he said. "There were genuine humanitarian reasons, too, but there was a synergy between those reasons and the desire to hang out with famous people and to be recognized for it. My mother has said that he would never admit this, but the year he spent in Marseille was the best year of his life. I can imagine that he was on a manic high the whole time." Yet something about the manic side of Fry's personality crossed the boundary from troubled into visionary. "As my mother would say, he didn't suffer fools gladly," Jim Fry said. He mentioned his father's resignation from the New Republic as an example of his father's theatrical breaches with people. Fry had quit the magazine in a rage over his fellow editor's refusal to condemn Stalin during the war. In hindsight, Jim Fry mentioned, almost as an afterthought, he was right. That rightness gave me pause. It was the same rightness that Fry exhibited in Berlin in 1935, when the rest of the world was looking for ways to compromise with Hitler. The same rightness that took him to Marseille, the same rightness that wouldn't let him leave. Perhaps Fry actually was, as Mary McCarthy wrote, a perfect madman. To perceive the blinding, irrational vastness of absolute evil, one almost needs to be mad. When I asked Jim Fry for his own version of what makes a righteous person like his father take the risks that he took to save others, his answer was equally unsteadying. "Maybe you need to be a little unhinged to do something foolhardy like that," he said. He added with a laugh, "If Prozac had existed in the 1920s, we wouldn't be having this conversation." Then, in a quieter tone, he told me, "What I think is most interesting is how someone so troubled could have done something so valuable and important." He read me his favorite quote about his father from a review of Andy Marino's biography by Christopher Caldwell. "Fry was impossible to work with, mentally troubled, locked in himself," Caldwell wrote. "But let us not forget that he was a prophet, too, and put himself in harm's way to prevent the future he saw unrolling before him. Not the ideal person, maybe, but certainly the kind that every generation has always had too few of." Fry may have been a misfit, as Miriam Davenport put it, a trivial word often used for artists and the other thinkers Fry saved. But artists and thinkers at least know that Western culture honors their kind of work. Indeed, Western culture views them as the guardians of civilization, as the Emergency Rescue Committee did. There is no such cultural assumption among heirs of the humanist tradition about righteousness. It is considered unremarkable, banal. It is not considered what it actually is. Prophecy. Varian Fry's oddness is not that of a Marcel Duchamp. It was that of an Ezekiel. The real reason that no one today has heard of Vivian Fry is because the gift he had is not one that we value. It is easy to forget that there are other values a culture might maintain, other people whom one could consider guardians of civilization instead of artists and intellectuals, and that a large proportion of the people who were actually murdered in the Holocaust adhered to one of these alternatives. Fry tried to save the culture of Europe, and for that he should be remembered and praised. But no one tried to save the culture of Hasidism, for example, with its devotion to ordinary everyday holiness, or Mishnaism, the opposing religious movement within traditional Eastern European Judaism, whose energy in the years before the war was channeled into the rigorous study of Musar, or ethics. Entire academies devoted to the Musar movement were destroyed, their books burned out of the world, their teachers and leaders and scholars murdered. All the things that everyone feared would happen to the vaunted culture of Europe. No rescue committee was convened on behalf of the many people who devoted their lives and careers to what Pierre Sauvage laments that no one pursues. The actual study of righteousness, For them, there were no Varian fries. I returned from Los Angeles in the depths of a frigid winter night, coming home to the warm, dim nightlights of my children's rooms. My 5-year-old had papered my refrigerator with incomprehensible drawings to honor my return. I thought of Aube Breton, the 5-year-old budding surrealist with whom Fry once lived at Herbel, who now sells her father's papers at auctions for enormous sums. My own 5-year-old's work surely could never compare. Yet on the long, dark flight home from Los Angeles, as I took part once more in the obscenely false game of wondering who should have been saved, I could not help wishing that instead of an emergency rescue committee saving Europe's greatest artists, that there had been an emergency rescue committee saving Europe's greatest prophets. That perhaps what should have been saved was not more of the culture of Europe, but more people like Varian Fry. On the morning of September 13, 1967, Varian Fry failed to appear at his new job at a high school in Connecticut, where he had recently been hired to teach Greek and Latin, his greatest love, the foundation of European civilization. When he didn't answer his telephone at home, his former wife, Annette, who had divorced him 2 weeks prior, received a phone call. She immediately contacted the Connecticut State Police, who sent an officer to knock on his door. The policeman found Fry sitting in bed with his glasses on his lap, his sheets and blankets covered with typewritten pages from his autobiography. He was revising it for an abridged school edition, which was later published under the title Assignment Rescue. He had suffered another heart attack, this one fatal. He was 59 years old. The police officer noted the contents of the manuscript scattered around the bed, detailing Fry's valiant attempt to save the culture of Europe. It appeared, the policeman reported, to be a work of fiction.